Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Teresa Toulouse and Barbara Yule, co-editors of Sweet Spots, In Between Spaces in New Orleans. We'll also hear from novelist Caleb Johnson about his enchanting debut, Treeborn. Teresa Toulouse is professor of English at the University of Colorado Boulder and was previously professor of English and director of the American Studies program at Tulane University. Barbara Yule is the former Dorothy Brown Distinguished Professor of English at Loyola University, where she taught for 3 decades. Together, they are the editors of a new essay collection, Sweet Spots, In Between Spaces in New Orleans. We're happy to have Teresa Toulouse on the phone from Boulder while Barbara Yule joins us in the studio. Welcome, Barbara.
Thanks, Susan. It's great to be here.
You too, Terry.
Ditto. Greetings from Colorado.
Now, this is such a fascinating way to look at our city. And Terry, you start this book by talking about how it grew out of a course you taught with architect Mack Hurd, who taught at Tulane while you were there. And that course sounds just fantastic. So tell us about that.
Well, this started in the 90s, and I had made friends with Mac because we sang in the same choir. It was not because I was looking for architects, but we started talking, and we realized that while there were history courses on the city or lit courses on the city or architecture courses on the city, that nobody had tried to bring any of these together. So it was really a new kind of scary attempt to try to pull together different ways of thinking about the city. So it was called New Orleans as a Cultural System, and the late Diana Pinkley was very instrumental in helping us get this course advertised in the Chronicle of Higher Education. So it got a lot of play because it was so weird. But we talked about the intersections of food, space, music, and ritual for about 10 years because we wanted to see the city as a system. How did all these different pieces of it work together? So it really was one of the first Tulane courses that crossed disciplines, not only disciplines, but schools. So when Mac became so sick and died in the spring of 2001, I promised him that I would work up some aspect of the course into a book. So I came back to town for sabbatical in 2013, and that promise was pretty delayed. So I began to close in on this idea of interstitial space. This is a feature of the city he just loved, and to talk it up with a whole range of people, some of whom known Mac, who helped us plan that course, who came to speak in it, and people who just loved the idea of interstitial space. And Barbara helped organize a conference about all this with interested folks about, I guess it was January 2014. So it's taken 5 years now, but with Barbara's really immense help, I finally kept the promise.
We should point out that Mac wrote one of the best books about New Orleans French Quarter Manual.
Yes, indeed. And he was writing it in the time period while we were teaching the course and while he was putting an addition on my own house. So all these things kind of came together.
In life and in book.
In life and in book, right.
So that was the beginning for you, Barbara, organizing that conference. That's how you got involved in this project?
Yeah, right. It was really a little seminar at Loyola where we brought together, I don't know, it was a dozen people or so, just to talk informally for a day about the notion of interstitial spaces and how disciplines might come together and what people might want to talk about. And then from there, we just went forward with putting the essays together and collecting them. That's how I got involved.
So, Terry, talk about what an interstitial space really is.
Well, let's talk about what architects think.
Yes.
John Klingman told me a lot about. So apparently the term comes into architecture in like the late 50s and early 60s, and people relate it to the Salk Institute that was built in La Jolla by Louis Kahn. And Kahn built, I love this in terms of New Orleans, built what he called servant spaces over the served spaces of the labs, below them. And these servant spaces included the pipes, the electrical elements, and then they also referred to other hidden ways, staircases. He was one of the first people to sort of put staircases kind of on the outside of a building so they didn't get involved in what was going on inside it. So all of these became known as interstitial spaces. For New Orleanians, such spaces might recall hidden service staircases, say, in mansions. But also, in Creole townhouses, there's a kind of half floor, particularly if people had a business on the bottom, there's a kind of half floor that they used for storage called the entresol that you can't see from the outside. It's not marked on the facade. But the idea of the interstitial in New Orleans has most commonly referred to not to spaces within houses, but to in-between spaces that link the inside and the outside. So galleries, balconies, porches, and courtyards. And Carrie Bernard's essay in Sweet Spots talks about roof overhangs, crawl spaces, and porte de cochere. So there's a whole range of features that connect the inside and the outside in nuanced ways. So in both these instances, whether we're talking about interstitial features inside or those that are linking inside-outside, we're referring to spaces that accommodate needs without interfering with other major activities going on inside.
Now, talk a little bit about Sweet Spot in the title, because everybody likes to imagine they have a sweet spot in New Orleans.
What we wanted to do with the idea of sweet spots, and Barbara, feel free to chime in here, is that we thought that the phrase, which of course talks about the point between jazz musicians and their hearers or their auditors or their machinery recording them, where the sound seems to resonate most sweetly or most intensely. So the sweet spot is an actual spot. It's a spatial spot, but it's also obviously been given connotations. It's been given emotions and associations. So we thought the idea of talking about interstitial spaces as sweet spots would add this dimension of cultural meaningfulness to these spaces. So the ideal title, I think, for us was something that would pull together experience and association with space, and it's Sweet Spots that did it for us.
So what's your sweet spot, Barbara?
Well, it's hard to say. All of these essays were really so exciting to work with. I mean, we had such great writers and wonderful different contributions. I think we have six or seven different disciplines in this book.
And different tones and different writing styles, yeah.
Right. And I think for me, though, the architectural stuff is very interesting, and the foundational essays at the beginning, which talk about how from the very beginning, the city, because of the curve of the crescent and then the rather arbitrary laying out of the plantation lines, as the city developed, these odd little interstitial spaces got left over and then were sort of became markets and parks and things like that, that then, in fact, kind of defined the city. It's what Teresa was saying earlier about these seemingly not very important spaces, a balcony, an overhang, really come to define the space itself. So those essays kind of lay the foundation for the text, but also for the city and the way the city has developed.
Well, it's so interesting when Scott Bernard writes about the pleats.
Yes,
the pleats
and
along, pleats,
pleats
and notches.
That's such a wonderful metaphor.
Of the landscape or in the curve of the river. And I spend hours contemplating what life would be like with the Britannia Market. I think that would be so fabulous.
Right.
Because I drive by it every day.
Yeah. And the little Dublin Market that no longer exists. I mean, all of these little tiny places. And some of them, of course, still do exist, little tiny pocket parks and odd, you know, the way the city is so odd when you drive around and suddenly three or five, not four, come together in strange ways.
Or Y Street jogs in a particular corner.
Right. But then the jog in it creates this little demarcated space. It doesn't let the space go continuously. It just makes it like it's a little tiny moment of enclosure there before you then move on to the next space.
Yeah.
It makes you think.
Yeah,
it makes you think.
And makes you slow down.
One hopes.
Yeah, right. But, I mean, of course, that's part of it, too, isn't it? That these little marginal spaces make you kind of jog, as it were.
Now, one essay I particularly enjoyed was Beth Willinger's essay about the different types of spaces for women in particular.
Yeah.
Storyville and the Christian Women's Exchange. There are two extremes for you. So talk a little bit about those spaces.
Well, you know, what got me about Beth's essay, and I guess I had never thought about it this way, is precisely what you're saying, is the way that spaces are gendered, and that Storyville was gendered immoral and fit, you know, half of the virgin whore dichotomy. and then uptown spaces, for example, or certain spaces in the quarter old Creole spaces were gendered as virtuous and respectable. So then the issue becomes, what do you do with single young women coming into town, or older women too, really, towards the end of the essay? Where do you put them? So you can't fit them all uptown to protect them from prostitution. You can afford spaces downtown, but you're scared to put them downtown. So what they do is develop what Beth calls these, they call them homes, right?
Mm-hmm.
These in-between spaces between public interests, like those of the women putting them together, but also private interests, keeping these women somehow domestic or directed towards marriage, towards appropriately kinds of conservative goals. So it's a wonderful essay about something we take for granted, like the Herman Grima house, which was part of, I think, Barbara, wasn't the Christian Women's Exchange. They were terrified to put it in the quarter. It was around the corner from some of the dens of prostitution.
Storyville wasn't far away.
Right.
Bill it as home-like surroundings, that it's domestic, that a lot of these places had matrons who were called mother. So you kind of created these homes in the middle of these formerly or currently immoral spaces and tried to ensure the respectability of the women who live there.
One of the things about Beth's essay I think is also interesting is what she doesn't include, because she can't, and that's about women of color. Because while there's a pretty clear record of what happened to single women coming to the town, white women, and the other thing too is the way that housing these women empowered the women who were in charge, you know, creating the houses and so forth. So there was an interesting kind of dynamic there. They're helping these young women as they empower themselves. But the business about the women of color is that there were clearly houses like that for those young women. There is some record, but not very much. And that erasure is something that then Angel Parham takes up in her essay on Congo Square, the way that place has, its meanings have moved in and out, and some of its meanings have been erased. It's a, you know, it's a very marginal interstitial space, wasn't necessary to the city, on the edge of things, and yet in many ways without Congo Square and the definitions of blackness that have emerged from that space, there would be no New Orleans.
And
it's,
I think that's one of the most important essays in this book.
I agree.
Oh, indeed, yeah.
You know, it's fascinating to read, just fascinating. Well, thank you for this book, which gives us so many great new lenses through which to view the city. We've been talking with Teresa Toulouse and Barbara Yule about their fascinating book, Sweet Spots, In Between Spaces in New Orleans. You can meet them Sunday, June 17th at 3:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Terry, thanks so much.
And thanks so much for having me. And I look forward to seeing people on the 17th.
All right. Thanks, Barbara.
Oh, such a pleasure. Thanks, Susan.
Every now and then, a first novel comes along that just wins your heart. You read that first page, then you enter a world you never want to leave. Caleb Johnson's Treeborn is just such a book, set in his native Alabama. Caleb studied journalism at the University of Alabama at Tuscaloosa and creative writing at the University of Wyoming. He's speaking to us today from Philadelphia, where he lives and teaches. Caleb, so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. I am thrilled to be here.
So tell us a bit about growing up in Arley, Alabama, and how it made you a writer.
You know, growing up for me, it was really a place outside its time in a lot of ways. Now looking back, I spent every weekend and many weekday afternoons when I wasn't playing sports just roaming around the woods with my friends, especially on my grandmother's land. And I really think those woods and that place is where I became a storyteller, because I would walk around and I would come upon things, you know, maybe it was a crumpled piece of tin blown from a storm, or maybe it was some trash washed down the creek from somewhere else. And I would come across these objects that just didn't belong there, or didn't seem like they belonged there. And I would start to wonder about how they got there, where they came from, and who else may come upon them one day. And that's kind of where I started making up stories for one of the first times.
Well, so much of Southern writing is falling in love with a particular landscape. I think in in Louisiana of how we love James Lee Burke's depictions of our landscape. And yours is so magical. There's this wonderful description you have of Janie Treborn, who's one of your characters. And you say, stretches of the forest were how the girl imagined the innards of churches and castles she'd read about in books from the library where her mama worked. Quiet, enormous. I love that. So that is a storyteller's way of looking at the world.
Sure, and Janie's experience and her relationship to the land, it's not a one-to-one representation of mine, but I did channel a lot of my childhood there in Arley, in the woods, and along the lake, and the rivers and streams. It was a place and is a place still, when I'm blessed enough to go back, that I just have a lot of reverence for. And, you know, I grew up in church, but also the nature and the woods were my church in a way, and I just can't help but walk through those places and feel something mythic and bigger than human beings, and something just really spiritual that strikes me down in the bones.
Well, and you really capture that feeling of being not in nature, but of nature. And you write about the land itself, its richness, the seasons, the weather, the things that come from it, and the passage of time as this gorgeous place falls prey to time and change. So talk a little bit about what's going on in this book with this wonderful landscape.
Sure. Well, the story isn't told chronologically, and that was a conscious decision on my part because I was really interested in how memory works and our relationship to it and how we alter memories the more we handle them and the more we tell them. So it's told out of order. It opens near the end with Janie Treborn, who's sort of the last surviving member of the Treborn clan, talking to an unnamed visitor. And it becomes apparent quite quickly that the town of Alberta, the land Janie grew up on and the last bit of land she owns, is about to be just literally washed away when a hydropower dam has imploded. And she's holding out. She's stubborn. She loves this place, and she's just not ready to go. And kind of all she has left in her power, she feels like, to do is to tell her stories, to tell the stories she experienced, the ones she was told by her family, and that's what she begins doing.
I do love her sheer cussedness, you know?
Yeah, she's an ornery character for sure.
Oh, so tell us about some of the other characters that you've created in this landscape. Hugh Treborn is a really interesting character.
Hugh is Janie's granddaddy. He is, for lack of a better term, an outsider artist. That kind of art is something I've always been really interested in, whether it's going to Howard Finster's place in Georgia or, you know, seeing Thornton Dial's pieces closer to home. So as Hugh just kind of developed as a character and walked this landscape, much like I did as a kid, he came upon things and he started cobbling them together and making what he didn't know at the time, but what was art, works of art, and he calls these assemblies. And sort of his presence, he's passed away by the time Janie comes of age, and sort of the central action of the novel starts to kick into gear, but his presence is very much real to Janie and to his widow, Maybelle Treborn, to his friend Lee Malone, and it's there in a spiritual sense, and it's also there in a real tangible sense with these assemblies that he has created and then strewn all over the land for folks to find.
And then Lee Malone is a kind of artist himself as well.
He is. Lee's a musician. He plays guitar and he writes songs. He and Hugh both, at times, they may be two sides of the artistic coin. They're reluctant artists at times, and sometimes they are frustrated artists, sometimes they're ecstatic artists. You know, their relationship changes as the landscape does, I think, too, and as time passes. But yeah, Lee, he plays guitar. He has one chance later in the book to kind of leave Alberta and go make his music, and he winds up telling that story, and Janie, the girl, pieces it together as well through some artifacts that she comes upon.
Well, you know, so much of Southern literature centers around those great four cornerstones of faith, race, place, and family. I mean, how conscious were you of fitting this story into a tradition and making it something new as well?
Certainly, I very much wanted to be in conversation with Southern literature. It's my heart and it's my home, and I wouldn't be here talking to you today without some of these writers. You know, when I was 14 years old for my birthday, my aunt, my mom's sister, gave me a copy of Larry Brown's novel, Dirty Work. And I was maybe a little young to fully get everything going on in that novel, but that was the first time when I understood, wait a second, there's literature happening in my home. It's being written by people like me and my family, and about people like me and my family and the folks I'm growing up around. So that was one of the main things I wanted to accomplish with this book, was to amplify those voices that I grew up among in reality and those voices that I grew up among in books, and just sort of make sure they're still being heard in American literature, because I think at times they fall in and out of fashion, or they're maybe taken and made grotesque or made not grotesque but more palatable. And it was something I wanted to do, was to just present them in a way that was as honest and true as possible to my growing up.
And you've made your characters rather grand and mythic
mm-hmm.
in this book. That must have been so much fun to write. I mean.
It was, and it could be, you know. And that was really, that was just an extension of my upbringing and growing up in a oral storytelling tradition that I think tends toward the mythic, and growing up in church, which certainly tends toward the mythic. And you know, myth to me is just, it's the stories we tell ourselves to, you know, figure out who we are and where we come from and where we're going. And that's sort of the struggle and the blessing and the burden of a lot of the characters in this book. Growing up in faith and growing up in a place and in nature that to me had a magical quality to it, it just came natural to have these characters be mythic as well. And their lives, while maybe not grand or mythic on a scale that people everywhere would recognize or say is that way, to me, the way they live and the things they're wrestling with are mythic, and they are admirable to watch unfold.
Now, you wrote a wonderful article about Gabriel Garcia Marquez's road trip through the South, and he's a writer who obviously means a lot to you and whose influence is clearly part of Treeborn.
Yeah, I didn't come to Marquez until I was actually in graduate school. I had left the South. I was living in Wyoming. And I'd had people tell me, you should read 100 Years of Solitude. I really think you'd enjoy it. But I had this ignorant, preconceived notion about it, that it was going to be a certain kind of book that I just would not enjoy reading. And finally, I got a used copy at the bookstore in Laramie, Wyoming. And I started reading it, and I got not 5 pages into it, probably. And I thought, well, Foot, this guy's written the novel that I'm trying to write, and it's a million times better than any version that I'll be able to write. And very quickly, I consumed his fiction, I consumed his nonfiction and his biography, and I realized we had some things in common, even though we grew up an ocean apart and decades apart. And I just felt this intense connection to him that I think readers can feel to a writer who has done his job and has done his work, like Marquez does in that book and others. You know, whether it was his time spent with his grandparents in the village they lived in Colombia, and my time in Arley at my grandmama's house, or whether it was sort of this interest and obsession with putting the supernatural and the magical alongside the real and kind of blurring those lines. Those are things I find interesting in life and also in storytelling.
And you also have a great passion for writing about food, don't you?
I do. I have a passion for writing about it and consuming it as much as possible.
And that'll be part of your visit here, actually.
It will, yeah. So I'm going to read from Treeborn and be in conversation with local New Orleans novelist Katie Simpson Smith. And we're going to do the event at a restaurant called Turkey and the Wolf, where one of my best friends from college is a sous chef there now. And he's been a longtime reader of this book and its various iterations, and just really supportive of me and my writing. So when I found out I was going to come to New Orleans on tour, I started talking to him about, hey, man, I think it could be really cool if you maybe did a pop-up menu based on the novel. So my publisher was really into it, which I'm very grateful for. And so my friend Nate Barfield is going to smoke some pork and make barbecue sandwiches, and then he's going to do some peach pie too. And I think we'll probably have a jug or two of sweet tea there.
All right. That sounds fantastic. We've been talking with Caleb Johnson, whose fabulous new novel is Treeborn. You can meet him Tuesday, June 19th at 6 when he appears in conversation with Katie Simpson Smith at Turkey and the Wolf, 739 Jackson Avenue, and the menus inspired by Treeborn. For more information, go to GardenDistrictBooks.com. Caleb, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Susan. It was a joy talking to you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Patsy Burdeen appears with her dog Mo to discuss and sign her children's books, Miracle of Mo and Stella and Mo's Big Adventure, Sunday, June 10th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. Nancy Wilson signs Mamere's Country Creole Cookbook, Recipes and Memories from Louisiana's German Coast. Tuesday, June 12th from 9 to 1 at the Uptown Crescent City Farmers Market, 200 Broadway at Uptown Square. The Garden District Bookshop Book Club discusses Colson Whitehead's Underground Railroad. Wednesday, June 13th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Novelist Rupert Thompson signs Never Anyone But You. Wednesday, June 13th at 6 at Octavia Books. Learning Before Lunch presents Baton Rouge Advocate columnist Danny Heitman discussing his book, A Summer of Birds, John James Audubon at Oakley House, Thursday, June 14th at 9:30 a.m. at the Earl K. Long Library at the University of New Orleans, room 407. There will be a launch party and panel discussion of Gateway to New Orleans, Bayou St. John, 1708 to 2018. Edited by Mary Louise Kristovich, Florence Jumonville, Heather Veneziano, and written by Hillary Irvin, Stephanie Bruno, Heather Veneziano, S. Frederick Starr, with photography by Robert and Jan Brantley, and a preface by Richard Campanella. That's Thursday, June 14th from 6 to 8 at the Historic New Orleans Collection Williams Research Center. Jonathan D. Voss signs his picture book, Brave Enough for Two, Friday, June 15th at 4 at Octavia Books. Tom Fitzmaurice signs Tom Fitzmaurice's New Orleans Food, more than 250 of the city's best recipes to cook at home. Saturday, June 16th from 8 to 11 a.m. at the Downtown Crescent City Farmers Market, 750 Carondelet at Julia. And the Octavia Books Book Club discusses Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad. Saturday, June 16th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Matthew Pearl signs his historical mystery, The Dante Chamber, Saturday, June 16th at 6 at Octavia Books. Teresa Toulouse and Barbara C. Yule discuss and sign their book, Sweet Spots, In Between Spaces in New Orleans, Sunday, June 17th at 3:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Caleb Johnson appears in conversation with Katie Simpson Smith and signs Treeborn, Tuesday, June 19th at 6 at Turkey and the Wolf, 739 Jackson Avenue. The American Library Association meets here in New Orleans June 21st through 26th. For information, check out ala.org. Featured speakers include former First Lady Michelle Obama at the opening ceremony, actress Viola Davis at the closing ceremony, poet laureate Tracy K. Smith and poet Jose Antonio Vargas, biographer Jonathan Eig, journalist Robert Fieseler, actress Sally Field, historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, Librarian of Congress Carla Hayden, with National Archivist Richard Ferrero. Art Club presents Pamela DeBar, best-selling author of I'm with the Band, Confessions of a Groupie, and Let It Bleed, How to Write a Rockin' Memoir. She'll be doing writing workshops Saturday, June 23rd and Sunday, June 24th from 1 to 5. For registration information and fees, visit pameladebar.net/events. And if you're looking for a book club this summer, Tubby and Coos offers four. They meet on Mondays at Tubby and Coos Mid-City Bookshop at 6. The first Monday of the month is the Graphic Novel Book Club, the second Monday, Science Fiction and Fantasy, the fourth Monday, the Not-So-Young Adult Book Club, for adults who read young adult books, and the online book club is online only. That's the Get Lit Challenge Book Club. For more information, contact Tubby and Coos. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. Thank you.